Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. 1 year ago on this show, we featured a look at how climate change is contributing to Western wildfires. 2020 was a truly terrible wildfire season across the West. And really, when we say that it was terrible, we're not talking about the numbers of fires that burn each season. That figure has actually stayed pretty consistent through the years. It's the size of some of those blazes that is especially concerning to researchers and fire authorities. 5 of the 10 largest fires in California history occurred last summer. Generally speaking, it's been extremely rare for wildfires to surpass about 300,000 acres in size. But that has been happening more and more. Last year's August Complex Fire, the largest that California has ever seen, burned more than 1 million acres. This year, the Dixie Fire, still burning in California, is getting close to the 1 million-acre mark. Oh, and by the way, it's the second largest fire that state has ever recorded. Scientists say a climate change-fueled mega-drought is contributing to conditions that make fires larger and more dangerous. Among other things, climate change is making us have to rewrite long-standing proverbs. Like, remember the phrase, "Where there's smoke, there's fire"? Well, as you've been experiencing all summer, that's not exactly true. Fire might be happening in a specific spot on the Earth, but the smoke is seemingly everywhere. Months and months of smoke from fires in California and Oregon have made our pandemic reality even more miserable than it already was here in northern Utah. And actually, on that point, it's kind of a compounding problem for the pandemic. A recent study from researchers at Harvard shows that exposure to the smoke impairs our white blood cell response in the lungs. That means less immunity, and actually it can mean a worse outcome if you do get sick. So just keep all of that in the back of your mind. On the show today, we're going to revisit the conversation that I had last year about that link between climate change and wildfires. My guest on the show says that we should expect the fires to keep getting worse as the impacts of climate change continue to be felt. Dr. Peter Glick is a scientist and founder of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security in Oakland, California. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and developed early assessments of the impacts of climate change on water resources, among a great deal of other work. He was also the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, commonly called a Genius Award, for his work on water resources. Again, this is my interview with him from last year. Peter Glick, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
You recently wrote a piece for the Guardian newspaper about the fire season currently underway across the western United States. And you say, while fires in the West are not unusual or unexpected, these fires are different. They're earlier, bigger, and hotter than usual. They are expanding explosively, overwhelming towns and firefighting resources, and there's no getting away from them. You say that this isn't normal, but that to a certain extent, climate science predicted this. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us about that part of the story, Dr. Glick. When were those predictions about the intensity or the severity of the fire season first made?
Scientists have been looking at the issue of climate change for decades, literally decades. I've worked on climate change and water resources for over 35 years, looking at how climate change, human-caused climate change, may affect water availability, extreme events like storms and droughts, changes in snowfall and snowpack. And there are many other scientists who have worked on all different aspects of the potential and unfortunately now real impacts of climate change, including on wildfires. Some colleagues of mine, for example, have worked on wildfire and climate issues since the very early 1990s, looking at the way rising temperatures and changes in moisture would affect fuel loads and fuel starts and fuel fire intensity and all of the things that, as you mentioned in your introduction, we're unfortunately now seeing. So this isn't new in the sense that we've been thinking these things were coming. What's new is they're now unambiguously here.
And are they unambiguously tied to climate change? I mean, I guess, you know, the sort of scapegoat that has emerged is forest management, the idea that we've been doing that poorly for so long and that that's the cause of the intensity or severity of these fires.
So let me be very, very precise and clear. I don't say, and climate scientists don't say, that climate change caused these fires. What we're saying is that climate change is now an unambiguous influence on these extreme events. And the comments about forest management are absolutely correct. Forest management certainly plays a role in the size of the fuel load, the speed of some of these fires, but it's not alone the actor here. What's happening is we have problems with forest management and fuel load. We have problems with extreme drought drying out soil moisture and vegetation. We have problems with rainfall patterns and snowfall melt in the mountains that disappears earlier, and so our summers are longer and drier. All of these things are contributing factors, but that's the important point. It's not causation, it's influence.
And that influence leads to, I mean, we're seeing, again, this devastating fire season, some of the largest fires that the West has seen. And I think California currently is seeing its largest single fire event, wildfire event.
By far, absolutely. It's the largest, and three or four of the largest 10 fires in California's history are literally burning right now. This isn't normal anymore. There is no normal anymore.
Going back to your Guardian piece, you write, projections have turned to reality. The future has arrived. What we're seeing now with massive wildfires, worsening storms, unprecedented heat, and record droughts and floods is just the beginning of the climate changes to come. You know, that's yet again another dire warning, but I'm wondering if you can describe what you mean by just the beginning. Where are we headed and how bad is it going to get?
Yeah, sure. So climate change isn't a static single thing. Climate change is a dynamic change, as the words say, in the climatic conditions and the weather conditions of the planet. We've been adding carbon dioxide and other so-called greenhouse gases to the atmosphere for over a century, when we started burning all the fossil fuels that we burn. But the impacts of climate change have not been noticeable until recent decades, and especially recent years, because we're in a phase where climate change is growing out of the noise of natural weather variability into a signal, as we call it, of clear change in climate. And it's accelerating. It's growing exponentially. And like any exponential curve, it starts off slowly and it grows faster and faster. And that's what we're seeing with climate change. So the impacts we're seeing now are going to continue, and they're going to get worse as we have failed to get the emissions of greenhouse gases under control.
You talked about that exponential curve, and I'm wondering what drives the fact that it's exponential. I mean, is there a kind of feedback loop mechanism in climate change, meaning, you know, a certain amount of energy going into the system, and then, you know, you have melting and you have more carbon being released from things like the permafrost. I guess, what is climate change?
So that's a very good question. So first of all, it's exponential, or it's been exponential, because our population and our economies have been growing exponentially. And so our use of energy, and in particular our burning of fossil fuels, which is the prime emissions of greenhouse gases, has been growing exponentially. The whole argument about how to deal with climate change really revolves around how do we change our energy system so that we can continue to have the energy we want to do all of the things that we want, to travel, to heat our homes, to run our industry, to grow our food, without emitting the same bad greenhouse gases. And that's the argument about switching our energy system from fossil fuels to renewable, non-carbon emitting energy sources. And that has the potential to change the exponential curve, to level off emissions and then decrease emissions. And that would change this from an exponential problem to maybe, hopefully, a more manageable problem in the future.
How about the basics? I mean, you said for over 100 years we've been burning fossil fuels. That's the major driver of climate change. Would you mind giving us that primer?
Oh, sure. It's very simple. It's been understood literally for over a century. The Earth, if it had no atmosphere, would be a frozen ball. It would not retain heat. The atmosphere, thank goodness, retains heat. And the Earth is the temperature it is because of the atmosphere, and especially the composition of the atmosphere. There are certain gases in the atmosphere that let sunlight through, but trap heat, hence the name, the greenhouse effect. Those gases are called greenhouse gases, and they're carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide are the major ones. And as we increase the amount of those gases in the atmosphere, which we've been doing for some time now, we trap more heat. And that's the basics of the greenhouse effect. And as we trap more heat, it changes everything associated with the climate, the weather patterns, the way the ice forms and melts in our mountains or in the Arctic or the Antarctic. It's connected to everything we care about.
Are the impacts of climate change, or maybe the strength of those impacts, I'm not exactly certain how to ask this question, but are they happening faster than scientists like yourself originally forecast? And are you how worried are you by, if there is acceleration, by that acceleration happening?
So the answer to that is complicated because it sort of depends on what impacts we're talking about. But the models that we use to try and understand what the impacts of what we're doing will be on the climate, we've been running them for decades, and they're really good. And they've been telling us to expect certain kinds of temperature increases. And the temperature increases that we've been seeing are perfectly in line with what those models have projected. The forecasts have been really good. What's happening faster is the consequences of the changes in climate, the changes in temperature that we're seeing. The Arctic is melting faster than we anticipated. Sea level is starting to go up faster than we anticipated. These wildfires are much more aggressive and extensive and faster than we anticipated, because evaluating the impacts of climate change, it's a hard thing and a complicated thing to do. So some things are happening worse and more quickly than we anticipated, and that's bad news.
One of the things about the fact that we're seeing these wildfires, and I'm sure this is a variable that's accounted for in those models, but part of that negative feedback loop is the fact that as trees burn, the thing that they're doing is releasing carbon, which is adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Here's another question that you've been asked certainly a number of times, but what should we be doing? How do we deal with this problem?
Well, so first of all, if there weren't more fires now than there would otherwise have been with climate change, then fires burn, they add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. But if things are in balance, vegetation grows and it takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That's what we call a sink for carbon dioxide. If we're burning more forests than forests are absorbing carbon dioxide, then that's a net source of carbon dioxide and it adds to the problem. The real problem, though, is not really the carbon dioxide from these fires. The real problem continues to be massively defined by the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. That's the biggest, by far, contributor of these greenhouse gases, and why there's been so much emphasis on a new way of thinking about energy, about figuring out how to accelerate our getting off of fossil fuels and onto these energy sources that are more sustainable in the long run and more benign to the environment.
There's a deadline approaching. The U.S. is slated to exit the Paris Climate Accord the day after the 2020 presidential election. And I guess a question for you is, how important is that treaty to our collective ability to tackle the problem?
This is a global problem. We can't tackle it unless everybody on the planet is involved, especially the United States, one of the biggest emitters and responsible for the most of the greenhouse gases we've added over time in the atmosphere. If we get out of the Paris Agreement the day after the election, the next president, whoever it is, could get back in immediately. Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Agreement was a political move. It was done to satisfy his base, but it potentially a temporary problem. And if there is a change of administration, the Biden administration will get back into the Paris Agreement immediately. Now, having said that, the Paris Agreement is just one step toward really addressing the problem of emissions of greenhouse gases. It's an important step. It's a step that the world community has agreed to take to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. But it's not very quick. It's not very fast. And it requires not just that the countries that have agreed to participate, but that they actually take positive action to reduce their emissions. And those are things that remain to be done.
And you say that we need to act much more quickly than probably that framework sets out. So is the technology there right now for us to stop doing what we're doing? I mean, maybe not living the exact same lives we lead, but, can we kind of cold turkey, quit carbon?
Well, so no one is proposing that we shut off every fossil fuel power plant tomorrow. That would cause huge economic, social, health, political disruptions. First of all, we couldn't do it. And I'm not saying we want to do it. What we want to do is accelerate the transition from fossil fuels to non-carbon sources as quickly as possible. And the technology absolutely exists. Solar, wind, geothermal, renewable biomass, hydro, nuclear potentially, if we could figure out the costs, safety, and security issues associated with it. There are lots of options. The trick is accelerating that transition, and that requires political strategies and policies to be put in place and economic incentives to expand renewables or economic disincentives to cut fossil fuels. There are a lot of strategies for accelerating that transition, and it's not happening fast enough yet. That requires political will.
And the barriers to that happening faster than it's happening now?
Well, the barriers are, first, a lack of understanding among the public and especially our politicians. The second is a very aggressive campaign on the part of certain political entities and certain industrial entities and the fossil fuel companies, of course, who have the most economically to lose here to try and prevent those changes or to confuse the public about the reality of the problem. Those have all been barriers. They've been barriers for years. I think the public has a growing understanding of the nature of the problem, in part because we're faced with these wildfires. We're faced with these hurricanes that are stronger and more frequent than ever before. We're faced with the reality of climate impacts. I mean, literally in our face, in our homes, in our states, all around us. We're also seeing more action on the part of not necessarily the U.S. federal government, but local entities and state governments. So we're moving in the right direction slowly. And I'm more optimistic than I've ever been about our potential to move forward. But again, we need to move forward much more quickly.
I'm going to say that I'm a little bit surprised to hear your optimism, given, first off, the decades of sounding the alarm that scientists like yourself have done. And then I think that I'm also surprised by it because of a seeming increase in a certain strain of anti-science rhetoric, especially being channeled through the internet and conspiracy theories that are, you know, rampant on social media and so on and so forth. And I'm wondering if your optimism, is it a kind of defense mechanism, if it's the only thing you've got? I mean, I don't mean to burst your bubble, I guess. I'm wondering, how do you stay optimistic?
Okay, so that's a great question. And there's plenty to be pessimistic about. The recent anti-science rhetoric and behavior on the part of certain people and certain parties and all around the world is depressing. I have to believe, perhaps, that it's temporary. That, I mean, even today, if you poll people about their faith in their religious leaders or their political leaders or scientists or the medical community, faith in science is still very high. There's also the fact that reality is sort of hard to deny. You know, you can deny that the Earth is round. You can deny that we landed on the moon. You can deny that there's a pandemic, but we landed on the moon and the Earth is round and there's a pandemic. I mean, the reality is hard to deny. And climate change it's possible to deny, but not if you're paying any attention to what's going on in the real world. And I believe, this is the optimistic side of me, that reality will win out. That the fact that we have solutions, that they're economic, that they're smarter and better will mean that we'll move forward on them. We are moving forward on them. Again, as I said before, I think we need to move faster. But what makes me optimistic is the reality that there's a problem, the realization that more and more people are aware of it, and especially the fact that there are things that we can do about it.
Yeah. Going back to the fires for just a quick moment, you're there in Oakland, California. I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners basically how bad it is there now. And I guess, are you worried that, you know, the place where you live and where millions of other people live is becoming uninhabitable? Not just Oakland, California, but much of the West right now.
So it's been terrible. It's been unbelievably bad. I've lived here for many, many, many decades, and there's been nothing like it in terms of air quality, in terms of the severity of the fires. The fires will go out eventually. The air will clear temporarily, perhaps. But it is true that some places, not necessarily California, or, you know, maybe parts of California, but parts of the Southwest, parts of Southern Asia and Bangladesh that's low-lying to sea level, parts of the world will become increasingly difficult to live in with the climate impacts that are now unavoidable, and people are going to move. Well, there's been a long discussion about climate refugees, environmental refugees, people moving. You know, people moved for years from cold, frigid Minnesota down to the Southwest where it was warm and sunny in the winter. But what happens when the Southwest becomes unbearably hot for months on end? People are going to move again. The wealthy are going to move back to more temperate climates. And the problem is going to be those populations, those disadvantaged communities that, because of poverty or for other reasons, are stuck and can't move and are going to bear the brunt of some of these now unavoidable impacts.
Peter Glick, we've gotten through the questions that I wanted to ask you. I guess any sort of additional thing you would want to impart to people who are maybe thinking about this with a renewed sense of urgency, and how they might, in their everyday lives, or how they might help impel change that will make a difference?
Sure. So there's a lot that people can do. And there's been a big discussion about this, about individual responsibility versus global action or national action or state action. And I'm an all of the above kind of a guy. You know, there are lots of things that we as individuals can do. I'm, to be honest, relatively well off enough to be able to put solar panels on my roof and to buy an electric car now, although they will become cheaper. That has reduced my personal carbon footprint. I have energy and water efficient appliances in my kitchens and in my kitchen and bathrooms, and that reduces my water and energy footprint. So there are lots of things we can do as individuals to reduce our own footprint on the planet, but we can't ignore the fact that individual action really isn't enough. We have to understand the science and push our policymakers to understand the science and to take action. The United States has to act, the world community has to act, our corporations have to act, and that requires putting pressure on them to do the right thing. So there's plenty to do individually in our houses, in our homes, in our families, in our communities. There are plenty of options for people who want to get engaged.
Peter Glick is a scientist and founder of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security, which is based in Oakland, California, among many other accolades, which I will leave out for now. But Dr. Glick, thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
And that's all the time we have for on In the Hive today from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. Find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.